Accession number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, Reel 12. We're talking about when you got to Kure and they put a wireless station ashore, yeah. And you were being asked to stay there, I presume. Yeah. Tell us what happened then. What did you do then?
Well, the reason I changed my mind and decided to go ashore, because I wasn't impressed with Kure at the time, because the dockyard was a sham. The Americans had bombed it. You know, the town was completely surrounded on three sides by mountains, and the other side was the harbour, the water. The whole dockyard was a mess of tangled wreckage. There was no properties in the centre of the town, only those properties up the hillsides. And if I remember rightly, it was January. There was mud and slosh everywhere. It didn't look a very appetising place at all. But as the naval party, and they were senior to me, kept taking some of my equipment off the ship to take ashore because they wanted it, I didn't envisage going back to Portsmouth and trying to explain away the fact I'd lost half my stores. So I volunteered to go ashore with a naval party, and I was one that was building the transmitting station in this warehouse. It's a very large warehouse, mainly a steel girder construction, with a ground floor, first floor of concrete, and then a roof, flat roof concrete. And in one corner of the first floor, we were building the transmitting station. We had one of these, what they call Mo Monsters. They were mobile radio stations, all on trucks, which they could take ashore in landings, and they had all the equipment, the transmitter. You know, each truck had transmitters in or receivers, or was the coding office or the message handling office, masts, cables, everything. And we had to get these cabins off the back of these 3-ton Chevrolet trucks up to the first floor. And this is where I had some Japanese workmen, were ex-Imperial Navy seamen, and they're absolutely brilliant. I mean, to see these people working with block and tackle and that sort of thing, and using a truck to lift. And they got all these things up onto the first floor for us. And we built the transmitting station. Then I had a job of running telephone cables right the way round from the receiving station, the transmitting station, for the keen lines for the transmitters. And they gave me a corporal and two privates from the Royal Signals who were telephone experts, because I knew nothing about telephones. And we had quite an amusing time going around the Japanese streets with these climbing irons on, climbing the telegraph poles and putting up the cables. And the thing was, the telegraph poles were about 2 foot from the front of the Japanese houses. And the amusing thing was, we used to climb up these poles in the morning, slide back, because all the Japanese houses got these sliding doors and windows, slide back the windows, and there was a Japanese family in their bed on the floor. And we used to say, "Ohayo gozaimasu," and they used to sit up in bed and say, "Ohayo gozaimasu," like they, so politely, like they. And then slowly the numbers started diminishing because of the demob situation. The signal officer went, and the chief staff officer took over as signal officer. And one day he sent for me, and he said, and I always remember his words, he said, "If a bird come down and plucked away half your staff, give me a plan that you carry on communications." Because at that time, the captain of HMS Commonwealth was the name of our base, HMS Commonwealth.
So you were with Naval Party 2504 at HMS Commonwealth, the shore station at Kure.
Yeah, after we built the shore station, it became HMS Commonwealth, you see. He had three titles, the captain, the original captain was Captain John Grindle. He was captain of HMS Commonwealth, naval officer in charge Kure, and port director, which was an American title, because the Americans sort of were in overall command in Japan, but we come under the army in the Commonwealth sector because they were in overall charge. And the interesting thing was, Captain Grindle was one of the old captains, you know, hang him from the yardarm, do this and that, but he's a brilliant captain, you know, great disciplinarian, but a very understanding man. And whenever an American ship came up to Kure, he used to order them to have three tugs. And even though they said they didn't need any tugs, he insisted, because we got paid in American dollars. And England needed American dollars. Any British ship come up and said he didn't want a tug, he could come up without a tug, Lofi. Anyway, the...
So it seems in your papers you joined, formally joined Commonwealth in June 1946. Mm. So the previous 5 months you've been ashore with the naval party.
2504, yeah, that would be, I suppose, yeah.
Now, what did you do when he said, plan for losing half your men?
I said, let me go away and think about it. Because at the time, you see, we were responsible not only for communicating with Commonwealth's warships, not only in the inland sea, but also their warships on patrol between Japan and Korea for smugglers and that sort of thing. Was also had responsibility for communications to Singapore, to Hong Kong, and also via those to Admiralty. We're responsible for all Commonwealth ships once they left Singapore bound for Japan for their communications. So there was quite large stuff because what we call the fixed service to Singapore required four operators, one every watch, you see, because it was a fixed service. Hong Kong, the same, it required four operators. And because then you have to have coders and message handlers and that sort of thing, and people in the transmitting station. Well, I come up with a plan which I don't think has ever been done before and don't think has ever been done since. I suggested that HMS Commonwealth become a ship. Now, we all know that normally they're called a ship, HMS Victory, Portsmouth, it was a shore base, but they're a ship. But from the communication point of view, she was a shore station. By calling her a ship, what we would do, instead of having to have four operators to read the fixed broadcast from Singapore, another four operators manning each of the other fixed services to Singapore and Hong Kong, plus four operators operating the local nets, I suggested that we acted as a ship, but a small ship, and small ships only keep what they call single operator periods for reading the broadcast, so you don't read it constantly. And any messages for ships with single operator periods go in certain times. Also, instead of having fixed services, we would act as a ship at sea by just coming up on one of the many, all over the world, they've got shore stations listening on what they call ship shore frequencies. And you come up and call a general call, and it could be Canada come back and answer, or one in India come back and answer, one in Australia or Hong Kong, depending on propagation conditions. And once they answered you, you'd shift frequency to a transmitting frequency, and they would take all your traffic. So I cut down the staff, from quite a large staff, to just myself and four radio operators. And I had one man on duty at a time, so they would just set watch for the single operator periods on the broadcast. Any outgoing signals, they would come up just when they had the signals as a ship, and it worked perfectly. The funny thing was, at the time I thought, well, I've been abroad long enough, I'd like to go home. And when I give out the suggestion to my boss, I said, you don't need me. I said, a leading telegraphist could take charge of those. Now, the yeoman of signals, he had four signalmen and a leading signalman. He insisted he was important and, you know, they needed him. They got rid of the yeoman of signals and kept me.
Now, wasn't this the time you got into slight trouble at some point? You lost your good conduct?
Yeah.
Tell me about that story.
Well, that was at the time when I was in charge around the transmitting station and I had a lot of vehicles around there. In actual fact, I'd never driven before, but I was taught by Raw Mean Driver, and I was taught on a 3-ton Chevrolet truck. And the captain gave me permission, because I had to go round to the main barracks every day to pick up fresh food, and also the rum, because of the daily rum ration. And whenever there was any stores arriving in the docks, they used to ring me up, go around and pick them up. So I had permission. I didn't have a license then, but you didn't need a license. It was in the occupation, that was it. And I was also given permission by the captain to use the truck to take my sailors into the barracks where they had a cinema, you know, if they wanted to go to the cinema, or also drop them off in the town. Well, this particular night, unbeknown to me, the chief yeoman of signals well, there was a case, I think, where he'd got an able seaman who was a dispatch rider, drunk, and to keep him out of the way, he put him in the store where he kept all his flag and bunting material and locked the door. And of course the lad got in a panic and then bang, bang, bang when he came to. And this chief yeoman evidently was involved in a lot of rackets. He was involved in, because there's a lot of black market went on in Japan at the time, he was evidently involved in a lot of black market. And what he was doing, anybody could do black market there and get thousands and thousands of yen, but getting the hard currency was difficult. But what he was doing was contacting all the troop ships coming up with the troops to Japan, getting in touch with the purser on board, and offering them a better rate for yen than the normal rate, you see. So he was able to get Australian currency, New Zealand currency, sterling, that sort of thing. And so it looked like this was going to be a big sort of investigation. And one of the officers reported seeing me driving my truck out of the port directorate that evening. So they thought, being as I was a petty officer telegraphist in the communication branch, he was a chief yeoman, I might be involved in the racket. So I had 6 charges against me. And what happened is I'd dropped the lads off, and picked some other lads up who had come across on the boat from the cinema to take them back to the transmitting station. And when I got back, I'd had a few gin and limes, because that was what the only gin we had, and I was quite well under the weather. And next thing I knew, I was being shaken by the duty petty officer, who was the PTI, and he said, "Did you drive your truck last night?" And I said, "No," because I hadn't got a clue whether it was last night or this morning or what, and I just said no. Then when I go up for the captain on these charges, the captain scrubbed out all 6 charges. He said, "That's rubbish, that's rubbish, that's rubbish," because he knew he'd give me permission to drive this or that. And then they added one extra charge, did tell a lie, and I didn't drive the truck. And because I was confused when I was asked, I was half asleep, you know. So, and then I was offered, would I take court martial or captain's punishment? I said captain's punishment. That's when I lost my good conduct badge. And then after a period of time, you get it back again, you know, with good conduct.
Yes, it says about a year later you get it back.
Yeah.
Now, anything else happened while you were there? Well, I mean, were you involved in any black market activities yourself?
No.
Why not? I mean, a lot of men did, you know.
It was so stupid, you see, because I see the signals. And there was a signal came from England to the captain saying that it was noted that the men in HMS Commonwealth had banked more money in their post office savings than their salary. You know, to me it was stupid. You know, the one thing that was unusual. My house girl, when I was in the transmitting station, eldest brother had been in the Japanese army, and he was captured in China, and a lot of these prisoners of war were taken to Russia, and the Russians brainwashed them in communism. This is why there's a lot of trouble with the communists in Japan after the war. Her sister-in-law, the wife of this brother of hers, had a little noodle shop just down where the workmen used to go in. And she used to live with her. to keep her company. And I'm going ashore this night with my Royal Marine driver at the time. We were just going, let's say going ashore, we're already ashore, but it's a naval term, going ashore. And outside this little noodle shop was a whole gathering of Japanese. And I noticed one of my house girlfriends, her name was Ayako, but we all gave them English names. I used to call her Margie. I noticed one of Margie's friends, a girl called Hisako. And I said, Hisako, I said, what's going on? So she said, Margie's brother is in the hospital. Maybe tonight he will die. Because he was suffering from malnutrition, this and that. So I said, why isn't she at the hospital? Because actually the hospital was one building still standing in Kure. And she said, because of the Indian soldiers. Well, they had Indian troops there as well, and they were quite ignorant. Their leave expired at 10 o'clock. But they used to, with all their boots and gaiters on, they would just open Japanese doors and walk through the house, treat them like, they were conquering heroes and that sort of thing. I had no sort of respect. And so Margie, with her sister, younger sister, was staying guard on the house until 10 o'clock. So I said, well, if her brother's soon to die, I said, go in and tell her I'll come back at 10 o'clock with the truck and take the two of them to the hospital. Which was highly illegal because officially there was a non-fraternisation ban. Japanese nationals weren't allowed to travel in our transport. Unless, of course, it was official, labouring transport. And so I said to the Marine, you carry on ashore, I'll go back to the camp, the transmitting station. And at 10 o'clock I came down in my 3-ton Chev, put the two girls in the front, drove them into the hospital, and I said, I'll back my truck up here. And it was between a lot of bomb buildings and that sort of thing. I thought, turn the lights off, put it back there so perhaps the MPs wouldn't see me. And she'd only been gone in the hospital about 5 minutes. She'd come running out crying, and I put my arm around her, and I said, what's up? She said, brother's... I wouldn't remember, she said, brother die, just like that. So I said, oh, I'm sorry, you see. So I said, come on, I'll take you home. Well, I couldn't take a ride home because the truck just had to stop, and she had to walk the rest of the way. But she said, would I take the family home? So without thinking, I said yes. The next thing, what I didn't realise, in the Japanese hospital, at that time, there's no facilities, so all the family used to move in. They took their own bedding, all these, rolls of bedding and pots, pans, charcoal fires, everything else, do the cooking, everything else. So in the actual hospital walls, there's all these different individual charcoal fires, cooking meals for the patients. And about 15 of them come out, all the relatives, everything else. And I thought, well, I'm going to get clobbered here. So I said, well, you put Mama there, because it was a mother and she just lost her eldest son. You feel sorry. I mean, anybody would. So I said, you put Mama in the front, you sit in the front with Mama. Tell the others to get in the back, to keep down low, because you've only got a side of, I suppose, about 2 foot the size of it. Well, I looked back and I couldn't see any of them. All these jokes, they can squat down there. They're all hidden down with all their paraphernalia. And I drove back, because they were going back to Mama's house, which there's a little pathway going up the hill by where the sister's shop was, up to the house, halfway up the hillside. So they all got off, and they all disappeared, and she said, Mama says, will you come up the house? And I said, no, I said, and she spoke quite good English, my house girl. I said, look, we just finished a war. I said, you started it, we finished it. I said, but we just finished fighting. I said, I don't think it's the correct place for me to be when you just lost someone through that war. So she said, okay, I understand. And I went back. Next morning she came in and she said, Mama insisted you come up the house tonight. You are the honoured guest. And so I went up there, and it was funny. Each Japanese house has got a little shrine in, and all the neighbours are coming in, and they either put a tangerine or a flower or something on the shrine, that sort of thing, and then say their prayers. And the sliding door was back, and I was sat in the next room like a little Buddha sat there. And they're all coming and giving me presents, fruit and all this sort of thing. and Saki. And every year, on the anniversary of that man's death, that mother sent me a big basket of fruit. And, you know, couldn't get over it. Thought it was absolutely wonderful. She had another brother who had served in the army, and he presented me with a decoration that he won in the war, which is one of the orders of chrysanthemum, which is a solid silver medal about 1/8 inch thick. And he said, you are a friend of the family, and he gave me this medal.
Now, what did the Japanese girl... she was a servant, was she?
Yeah, we had house girls, you see.
What did the house girls do for you?
Oh, they did your laundry, made your bed, did your laundry, kept the place clean, that sort of thing. Of course, in the transmitting station originally, we had two house girls looking after us all, you know, sort of... We had a Japanese cook. Well, funny enough, he was an ex-Merchant Navy cook. The only thing he knew how to cook was fish and rice. So everybody amongst my lads, because I had a PO motor mechanic, a PO radio mechanic, four sailors who had to keep watch on the transmitters, because they were down in trucks, because they were very enormous things. They were down in, you know, towed trailers. I had two Japanese workmen, they're ex-Naval, Imperial Navy men. And we all individually taught old Cookie. He was quite a comedian, actually, old Cookie, for the Japanese. And they all taught him, you know, how to cook these things. He used to have a go at cooking everything, you know. In actual fact, this transmitting station ended up being in the area where the Australian Army Engineers took over. So we're more or less honorary members of their sergeants. We used to go down there quite regularly. And one of the things out there was you end up going around all the different sergeants' messes different nights. They come to your mess one night, you're in their messes other nights. Then after the transmitting station closed down, and I say I had one small station doing both transmit and receiving in the port directorate, we had individual cabins there, not just the radio people, but all the naval staff. So yeah, they'd house girls looking after the cabins. The sailors, they didn't have cabins. They were in sort of one Nissen hut, or two Nissen huts. But they had three old mamasans, as we called them. Mamasans used to do all their laundry and ironing for them, and that sort of thing.
Now, anything else happened while you were there?
Well, the interesting thing was when I was there on my own with, as I say, just the four Chilegovich, two signalmen and the leading signalman, all these merchant ships coming to Japan, they weren't allowed to come up to Kure during dark hours, you know, for the navigation purposes. So the thing was, they used to report their position, course and speed. Well, the staff officer was just along the road, and the staff officer, I used to do it all. As, you know, I'd go along there, and he had the chart out on the chart table, and I'd get the dividers out, and I'd work out from their position, course and speed whether they would make Kure before dark. Most of them didn't, and I used to have to send a signal saying anchor at Point Dexter, 4 miles due west of Mitsuhama, report any communicable disease on board. And I used to write these out and do them. You know, normally officers do it, but it was all left to me. I used to do all this. It was quite fun. And they'd come back and say no communicable disease on board, and I used to say pratique granted. And then, and I say, you know, they proceed up next morning. And I got to know most of the radio officers on these ships coming up there regularly.
And they were merchant ships?
Merchant ships, yeah. And we had troop ships coming in as well, bringing up troops and taking troops home with the Aussies used to be, and the Kiwis. Most of the merchant ships I used to go aboard and got to know. And quite often I could supply them with radio equipment because, you know, the world was our oyster there. Everything was ours. I mean, there was loads of stores in this warehouse because the Australian Army filled it up with all this Japanese stuff. If a ship wanted a valve or any bits of equipment, I could supply it. So I got quite friendly with the radio officers. The best smuggling racket I ever met was a radio officer on one ship. Long time's passed, so it doesn't matter about mentioning. I don't know his name or the ship now. And I'd gone aboard, and quite often the captain used to, of the ship, used to invite me and have a drink with him as well, you know, so, you know. And I'd gone into his cabin, and his cabin was packed full of aquarium, or aquarii, is it the plural of aquarium? All round his cabin, all these aquarium, and pumping oxygen in them all, full of tropical fish. And I said, oh, I said, you're a keen fisherman. He said, no, he said, it's a business. He said, I've got an elderly mother and a spinster sister, and she looks after my mother, and she's quite an expert on tropical fish. He said, well, I get these fish in Hong Kong dirt cheap. And he said, I bought a book on tropical fish, so I'm getting quite expert on it as well. He says, when I get home, he said, certain fish, he said, you can stick in wet cotton wool and post them express post. He said, they arrive alive. Others said, I put in a tin with so much water and so much air, solder the lid and send them. He said, she breeds them until they get big and flogs them for for a profit to these shops. The best racket I ever sold, and the customs ever twigged that one.
Was there much smuggling?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the one thing I learned there, you see, culture pearls is a big thing. Because, you know, the Japanese were the originators of culture pearls. Something I learned there, all this business about the customs officer psychology and this and that, it tends to be a bit of hogwash. It's inside information and knowledge from the other end. And this happened, there used to be one of the troop ships coming up, there was called the Canimbla. And it was a Australian Navy with a crew for this. And she was doing trooping back and forth. And she went back to Sydney after one of the trips here. And the customs officers walked aboard with a spanner in their hand with the correct size to fit a nut on the hollow mast. And they undid the nut. Well, it was a bolt, in actual fact. Undid the bolt. And there was a string tied to the bolt. When they pulled it up, there was thousands of strings of cultured pearls hanging down inside the mast. So they obviously were told by someone at this end. But the Australians, you know, we're all getting into quite a bit of smuggling, and some of our people obviously did it, but you know, to me, I just didn't have any time for it. The only thing that used to happen with me personally was because there was the currency you spent in Japan was BAFs, British Occupation Forces vouchers, but also in the Japanese shops you had to have yen, and I had a box in my drawer, and unbeknown to me, and the amazing thing was, my BAFs or my yen never seemed to diminish. And I found out later, my house girl used to take some of the BAFs and go to the Naffy shop and buy certain things in the Naffy shop. You know, supposedly for me. She knew they were getting a good price ashore. She would take them ashore, flog them for yen and fill up me yen tin. So the BAFs kept getting topped up by me wages sort of thing. And she'd been doing this for ages. I hadn't got a clue about it. She'd been keeping me well supplied with money.